This is 90.1 KPFT FM and FM HD1 Houston, with translators at 89.5 FM K208DG Galveston and 91.9 FM K220KC Huntsville. Houston's community station, 90.1 KPFT, a Pacifica radio station.
That sweet beat of Clouds Beneath Your Knees by Ray Lynch chimes in 5 p.m. Thursday, and you have tuned in for So What's Your Story? The only program originating in Houston devoted to storytelling. And it's found only on Houston's community station, KPFT. I'm Larry Thompson, tonight's host, and here we celebrate the power of story by placing the spotlight on tellers whose stories take us on voyages through windows of their souls and on fanciful excursions amid worlds of enchantment before it hopefully returning us safely to the present. And since you've tuned your radio or computer or tablet or phone to 90.1, So What's Your Story on Houston's community station, 90.1 KPFT, let's get to the reason you've tuned in tonight, great stories. Now, when my guest tonight was 4 years old, she told her mama she heard God's voice, and it was a woman. And since that day, this little girl has been fascinated with religion. Her name is Brooke Pilafont. I should say Dr. Brooke Pilafont. Now you're saying to yourself, Larry, really? A doctor on So What's Your Story? That's right, folks. A doctor. Brooke holds a master's degree in sociology with a concentration on statistics and a doctorate in complementary and alternative medicine. Along with stints teaching in middle and high school, she's been the high priestess of a coven in both New Orleans and Washington, D.C. That's interesting. For 10 years, Brooke worked as a mathematics coach and a teacher, until she took a miserable yet hilarious cross-country car trip that propelled her into the world of storytelling. It flung her headlong into performing at venues across the U.S. She's performed with Speakeasy D.C., Mortified, Risk, the Austin Writers Roulette, Dallas's Oral Fixation, and several Austin Backyard Story Nights. In 2013, Brooke founded a nonprofit for those who often go unheard in our communities. And when she isn't on stage, she occupies her time with shooting pool, roadside adventures, and welding. And I should mention all this with four kids, maybe five, I don't even know, I lost count. One of them, whose name is Magnus, best kid name ever. Sit back, tighten your grip on the steering wheel if you're driving, as I welcome in Brooke Pilafont. Brooke, how the heck are you? Are you a DIY bathroom renovation expert yet?
Hi, Larry. I would not claim expert yet, but I definitely can grout a mean tile.
Well, there you go. That's part of the battle, grouting a mean tile. I prefer to grout friendly tiles myself, but I hear what you're saying. Now, you have to be the winner of most diverse resume on So What's Your Story. Tell us, where do tonight's stories come from?
So tonight's stories come from a few different places. The first one I'm going to start off with is definitely the first story I ever told, the one you referenced in the intro. But several of the stories tonight come from my experiences in putting together a nonprofit that reaches out into the community to talk with people about their stories. And I'm saying real people. And these people often go, like you said, with their voices unheard. And they're the people in our communities that are incarcerated. And so I've also put a couple of their stories together tonight. So I'm going to read two of their stories and one piece of poetry, because not only do we do storytelling, but we also do poetry and a variety of forms of creative writing and literacy when we're working with the inmates at the different incarceration facilities.
Fantastic. Now we're going to start right off with a story you call How to Accidentally Become a Storyteller. And folks, if you've ever wondered how someone becomes a storyteller, Brooke says sometimes it just falls in your lap. Tell us how to accidentally become a storyteller.
I had no choice but to rally the troops, pack the car, and head out into the unknown. There was no other option. While away on business, my husband called to tell me that his mom was dying. And 2 days later, he said through his tears that he needed me. He needed me. His mom had passed away, and I sprang into action. Never mind that I was 6 months pregnant and about to take a 3-year-old and an 8-month-old on a 650-mile car ride. But here we go, Michigan or bust. Bust. It was Sunday morning, and I had spent the entire morning packing the car while entertaining Magnus, who was 3, and Leif, who was 8 months. I packed the car so tight that there's only room for me, the boys, and grandma, who we are picking up at 1 o'clock from the airport. And I kept the boys up, as any smart parent would do, so they would nap in the car. Then grandma called to say her flight was delayed. Then she called again and again and again. In fact, then she called to say that the pilot had turned around her flight in midair and flown straight back to Atlanta. At 3 o'clock, Matthew, my husband at the time, called to tell me that while he and his brother were driving home, they were in an accident and the car was totaled. He was stuck in a snowstorm in nowhere, Michigan. We kept waiting. At 7 p.m., grandma's flight finally arrived. But it was 9 p.m. when we got on the road, and the boys finally fell asleep around 9:30. Now, everyone travels a little differently. I happen to be the kind of traveler that likes to get on the road and get there as fast as possible. I like to watch the arrival time on the GPS, and I feel accomplished as it drops minutes. I drive fast to get there fast, and I don't want to pull over. I don't want to stop for food or get stuck behind a slow driver. But this would not be that kind of trip. It began to snow harder and harder, and I started feeling motion sick in the dark mountains. Around 1 a.m., we decided to stop for the night. The first hotel we stopped at, Grandma vetoed because there were smoking rooms. So we got back in the car and kept searching. An hour later, we found a hotel that was non-smoking. Oh, sleep, glorious sleep. When we woke up, the car was iced shut and the roads were closed. Okay, so my mom's from Texas. She's never quite seen ice like you get in the mountains of Virginia. So she's trying to chisel the ice with a big pen she found. And as we're getting ready to leave, Magnus decides that he's going to refuse to wear a jacket, even though it's freezing outside. I don't care. Just get in the car. For the last 2 days, I had promised Magnus he could watch DVDs. But now the DVD player is broken. I have no clue why. It won't work at all. We've been on the road for 15 minutes, and Magnus says, "Are we there yet?" And I reply with a casual, "Not yet. It's a long drive." Magnus says, "Are we there yet?" "Not yet, honey. It's a long drive." "Are we there yet?" "Not yet. It's a long drive." I look at my mom like I might lose my mind. Then she tells me that the book she bought had already had the opportunity to read to her grandson without me knowing, was about a family going on a trip. And the title was, "Are We There Yet?" She is so lucky she's still alive. Then, from the back seat, "Are we there yet?" And grandma shouts, "No!" 15 minutes later, a snowstorm hit, and we drove 45 miles an hour in crazy wind for over an hour. Oh, did I mention that since I'm almost 6 months pregnant, we've had to stop every hour for me to pee? I have to jump out of the car and rush through the snow into the back of a dirty gas station, and then sometimes it was just a false alarm. Around 12:30, Leif, my 8-month-old, began puking like a fountain. I started freaking out that he's going to choke. I think this is how Jim Morrison died. But I was driving, so my mom rode backwards, trying to tilt his head as I scanned for any sign of a town. "Don't kill us," she said from the back. Well, we found an exit that promised food and shelter. The shelter was a covered pull-through next to a hotel several miles off the highway. We walk into the Days End looking pretty wiped out. One child vomiting while the other is saying very cheerily, "Are we there yet? Are we there yet?" The woman behind the front desk took pity on us and let us use the hotel bathroom. In the hotel stood a large gumball machine that spiraled the gum down to its exit. Magnus must watch the gumball go around in the machine and began to throw a tantrum down the hallway when we directed him to the bathroom. Well, the bathroom consists of a one-person foyer, as well as the toilet and sink big enough for one person. But we have to crowd our entire crew inside. I've stripped Leif naked, and I'm washing off his clothes in the sink while my mom is handling the crying Magnus as he still hasn't forgotten the beloved gumball machine. Then an old woman and her cat in a carrier have to use the one-person bathroom too. So as I'm cleaning out puke from Leif's clothes, the woman stands in the foyer with all of us, waiting impatiently for me to finish while staring me down. So I gracefully step aside from the puke-filled room to let her and her cat go ahead. Meanwhile, Magnus decided that since Leif has his clothes off, that he should too. I tried to put his clothes back on him, but he refused to wear his shoes. The woman with the cat pushes by us to get out of the door, and Grandma finally found a quarter buried in the bottom of the diaper bag and escorted Magnus, sans shoes, to the beloved gumball machine. I broke down in tears. I called my husband and told him there was no way we could make another 450 miles. I tell him I love him. I loved his mother. She meant the world to me, but I just can't do it. And he very coolly replies, "Why not?" Let's just say that was the nicest part of the conversation. So we turned around, heading home. Leif kept throwing up. The snow kept coming, and we could only drive about 50 miles an hour. Then again, every hour I had to pee. On the last leg of the trip, we stopped for some food. And as I jumped out of the car, I heard this strange clank, but I couldn't figure out what it was. I dug around in the snow, but I found nothing. So we ate and then kept driving. As I pulled into the driveway of the house, I reached up to press the garage door opener, but it wasn't there. We searched the entire car, but it wasn't there. Then it hit me. That clank 200 miles back was the door opener falling off into the parking lot. Luckily, there was a spare key to the front door, forgotten under one of the many flower pots. After scouring the entire front yard, we were able to get inside. Thank goodness, because again, I had to use the bathroom. Well, this time, the toilet overflowed. So I cried again, so did Leif. But Magnus finally got to watch his videos. We decided to just sleep and unpack the car later. Michigan or bust? It was definitely a bust. So I wrote a Facebook note about this trip in February of 2009. And honestly, I was just doing it as a cathartic piece so that I could process this unbelievably, this horrible, no good, very rotten car trip. And a woman that was a peripheral friend at the time, she read it and contacted me saying she was writing a play. And she asked if I would consider telling my story on stage to an audience. And to be honest, that was something that I never expected in my entire life. So I gathered all the courage that I had and decided that I would do it. And I told the story on stage, and it was very well received, especially by all the parents in the audience. So she kept it in several iterations of the play. The play and the story were picked up in various cities in the Northeast. And honestly, I had a blast. And I didn't actually expect it to turn into anything else. Ultimately, it was done because I was never able to attend my mother-in-law's funeral. And so telling her story was a way for me to heal from missing it. And over the years, this story has kept her memory alive in my heart. She was a beautiful soul and one of the most generous and giving people I've ever met. And then my friend asked me to write other stories for her shows, true life narratives. And I decided I'd pull pieces from my own life. And they definitely came first from the tales of my terrible teenage years, full of angst and bad poetry. From there, I began to tell a tale about my roommate, Newton Ford. And while we all have roommate stories, most of them don't turn out to be that their roommate was a wanted bank robber who helped you hide a bunch of diamonds. That story proved far more interesting than the last, and I started to tell it at various storytelling events in DC. And I'd like to be able to tell you the first place I ever told that story, but oddly, the mind has a way of dumping details even when you really want to keep them. So I don't actually remember the first place I told it, but I could tell you 10,000 others. And from there, it just snowballed. And eventually I told it on stage all across the US, from San Diego to New York. And it was even picked up by a film team in a DC competition where they made it into a short film. And let me tell you what a surreal experience it is to see someone else play you in a story about your life. What an amazing experience. So that's in that way,
incredible.
I accidentally became a storyteller. That's set out to be one, but you know.
That kind of story has everything you need, though. There's drama, there's throw up, there's people needing to pee. These are the kinds of stories that move America in all sorts of directions. And that's classic. What we do here on KPFT every week. Now, I've always thought life is about milestones. You survive your teen years, as you mentioned. You graduate from different schools. You have marriages. You get your first gray hair. And some of the milestones cause us to stop and take stock and make changes. Now, Brooke, you reached a moment where you said you needed to stop talking and start doing. And that led to a thing called Rough Draft. Tell us, the good or bad results totally depend on us story.
So, you know, there's a point that you come to where you feel like your whole life is well planned, that you've done everything in the right order and that you've got everything going and you know where everything's supposed to be. And then boom, it seems to, explode into lots of millions of shards. And then you end up traveling across the country with four little kids in tow. And you once again live with your parents, who you haven't lived with since you were 16. And while I didn't expect it, I did wake up one morning and I was living with my parents in the middle of a very hairy divorce. And for that year, I spent a lot of time sitting in a purple chair, crying for what was lost, crying for my inability to do anything in the present, and crying because of my fear of the future. It was a lot of tears, almost a river full. In fact, Alice would have been proud. So at one point, my dad made me get out of the house and be with other humans. He said it wasn't healthy for me to just lament all day and stay in their house and take care of the kids. I didn't even have a friend I could go and see nearby. Everything I knew was over 1,500 miles away. So he did what any good father would do, and he signed me up as a player on his pool team. So every Wednesday night, we would go to a bar in Austin and shoot billiards against other teams. And that Wednesday was the only life I had. So slowly, I began to feel more and more like myself as time began to heal some of my gaping wounds. And I began to consider what my future might look like. So I talked about wanting to be back in education, doing something with storytelling, and becoming involved in social justice in the city. Well, apparently, I may have talked to the pool team about it a little too much, because one of my dad's friends on our team finally said, "Geez, woman, I'll get you an interview with the warden at the jail. Come pitch an idea." And so I did. And the warden accepted it. So I began working with a veterans pod at the Travis County Correctional Complex. Texas has been recently creating pods that are for veterans only in correctional complexes. And they include specific programming that is particular to veterans. And the storytelling classes that I was facilitating became one of those programs. So each week, participants, I choose to use participants, inmates, they would come to class and share their stories around a specific theme. In the beginning, it was kind of just a little bit willy-nilly because I had no idea exactly what I was doing. But as time went on, we worked together as a group. So they learned how to craft a story arc, develop characters, integrate details, and present their work to a live audience. And in the classes, emotions of all kinds would emerge and connections between people would forge understandings and friendships that may not have bloomed otherwise. And each year, we also hosted a Veterans Day storytelling event in the jail. Since the COVID shutdown, we haven't been able to have the yearly performance, but I'm really looking forward to doing it again. Veterans would work to craft stories about how being in the military impacted their lives in a meaningful way. And this could be from learning about their own personal strengths to making a new friend to examining their own self in relation to the world around them. We would have 8 storytellers share their stories to a chapel full of other inmates from the general population. And by full, I mean, we usually had 150 people there. Travis County Sheriff Sally Hernandez would attend and say a few words. And it was such an honor to have her there and like supporting what we were doing. It was a moving experience for everyone involved. It was cathartic for the vets to share their story in front of a live audience and receive positive feedback for their courage and willingness to tell a story. And then after the show, Rough Draft and our volunteers would host a lunch for all the vets. And after a few years of volunteering, a friend suggested that I create a nonprofit for all the work I was doing. And that's how Rough Draft was born.
Well, there you go. Now, that program has determined a way, and you have determined a way to use stories and use storytelling to help people process and help them deal with things that are happening in their life. It takes storytelling to a completely different level.
You know, I sort of have joked around in the past and said, you know, if I haven't made someone cry during one of my classes, then I haven't dug deep enough into the stories of their life. And that really is true. And there's nothing more satisfying to me than helping someone find a connection between a story and their life and their current actions, and to recognize that those actions came from somewhere and that you can change your story. Just because you might be incarcerated doesn't mean that that's the last chapter in your tale. And I tell them all, kind of the very first thing I do at the beginning of the class is I say, what would you do if you were reading a book and every chapter was the same?
That's a book you would put down right away.
Right. And that's what I tell them. If you're writing a story, the story of your life, and every chapter is the same, you know, it's the same arc. then why would you want to keep doing that? So we talk a lot about like changing those chapters in our life and shifting that narrative to like understand where we were to help us make the best decisions for where we can go.
Well, there you go. Now, folks, that voice you're listening to is our guest storyteller, Brooke Pilliphant. You're listening to So What's Your Story on KPFT 90.1 FM, Houston's community station, and 89.5 in Galveston and 91.9 in Huntsville. Don't forget Don't forget KPFT's free internet on HD2 to meet your news, arts, and entertainment needs. We're proud to be here on KPFT. So what's your story? Houston's community station with Houston's community show. Now, Brooke, you've raised children. You've taught middle school. You've written and performed stories. You've driven hundreds of miles in snowstorms. You've done classroom lectures. Is it safe to say that walking into prison on purpose was one of the more scarier things you've done?
Oh, 100%.
Done that myself, I can only imagine. And hearing those bars clank behind you, that's got to remind you of that clanking sound you heard when you were driving in your car with that. Ooh, you just hope somebody's on the other side to open those things back up for you. That is, I cannot. Now, this is going to lead us right in, because your very next tale you're going to tell us tonight comes from behind bars. Is this a story that is crafted by the participants in your programs?
No, this story is going to be about my experiences going into the jails for the very first time. And kind of
so
like
you call it a set of firsts. Let's hear
it. Orientation began with no transparent clothing or see-through garments of any type. No seductive clothing. No tube tops, halter tops, strapless tops, or backless tops. No muscle shirts. No spaghetti straps. No pajamas. No clothing displaying obscene or offensive language, drawings, or gang affiliation, drugs, or alcohol. No dresses or skirts with high-cut splits. No shorts shorter than fingertip length. No skirts shorter than knee length. It's also in your best interest not to wear jewelry, heels, or studded clothing. Oh, and no phones allowed, ever. Don't share your full name. Don't share the names of your family members. Never give out your address or share your phone number. Don't put money on anyone's books. Don't make outside phone calls for anyone. Don't bring anything in as a gift to anyone. Don't offer to help contact a person for anyone. Whew. And this was just the first few minutes. These are just the first few rules that go along with volunteering in a jail. And honestly, they're all there for good reasons, as each rule comes with a host of stories officers can tell you about what happened when someone broke one. So the first time I had to go into the jail, it was quite surreal. First off, you walk through the metal detectors. Okay, that feels kind of natural. I mean, we've all done that at like airports, right? But here you have to take your shoes off. Okay, that's fine. And pretty much everything. Then you go to the front desk with the most intense bulletproof glass I've ever seen. In fact, they put banks to shame. Then you wait and you check in with another officer, and you stand in front of these two large doors, and you hear this amazing sound click, and the door moves open slowly on a mechanical hinge, right? And you go into this holding area. It's kind of a small compartment, maybe, 10 by 8, and the door shuts behind you. But it's not like irregular doors, right? These doors are very disconcerting. this just feels so final, like you're going to be trapped. And there's a lot of loud clicking noises. And so it took some time to get used to all the sounds of the jail. But every time I stood in that holding area, waiting for the other door to open, I thought, please don't let the apocalypse occur right now, because no one would be able to get me out of here. If everyone turned to zombies or something terrible happened, I'd be locked in this holding cell all alone by myself. Anyway, I digress. And remember, there's not just one holding section. There's like five of them just to get to the program building where I'm teaching a class. You have to push a buzzer, wait to be contacted, and then a buzz releases a latch on the large metal door. And they tell you, quickly move in the door and move out. Make sure you close it all the way. Look around you that no one is around you so that you're not going to get like surprise attacked or something. Also, there are cameras everywhere, literally everywhere. And to walk down the hallway, the rule is you must stay on the right side. I was told that no inmate was allowed to speak to me. And I was told to always keep my head up and make direct eye contact with people so they knew you knew they were there. And let's be real. Everything around you is concrete and not exactly colorful or inviting. You walk amongst chain fences and caged in walkways. People stare at you, watch your every move, both the officers and the inmates. So my classes met in a program's building. And the first day I went in there, I had the unique experience of reality and your expectations being quite different from one another. I was handed a radio and assigned a classroom. Wait, what? I looked at the officer. You mean there won't be an officer in the room with me? I have 25 students. He says, okay, just hit the red emergency button if everything goes sideways. Someone will come for you. But I just kept wondering, how quickly could they get down the hall? Anyway, I was handed a roster and a set of pencils that were about 2 inches long. Some sharp, some not. And if you're wondering why they were only 2 inches long, it's because it's hard to stab a 2-inch pencil at someone or in someone. Anyway, we won't go to the darker side of things. We'll stay on the positive side. The pencil holder is a block of wood with 20 holes drilled in it where the pencils sit. It makes it easier to see if one has gone missing. And I was told explicitly to count in the pencils and count out the pencils. Nothing could leave the room. And we weren't allowed to dismiss class until all pencils were accounted for. So one day, I am passing the wood pencil collecting block around the class. And when it comes back, we are one pencil short. So this does happen sometimes. It's not out of the norm. And so I say to the class, hey guys, we're one pencil short. Please check around your table to see if it rolled onto the floor. Everyone kind of scrambles, looks around. No pencil. I say, hey, guys, please check in your composition books. Maybe it got stuck in one of them. Because, you know, this does happen. Sometimes somebody will tuck a pencil in a folder or in their composition book. And really, you don't even think about it. It's a very natural thing to do. So everyone's opening up their composition books and flipping through all the pages and going through their folders. No pencil. I say, hey, guys, we can't dismiss until we find the missing pencil. At this point, fear is rising in me, and I can't think of where else the pencil could possibly be. Inmates start getting a bit irritated with one another, and my radio is blaring with an officer asking me, are you ready to dismiss? Room 8, are you ready to dismiss? And I have to keep saying, not yet, officer. We're looking for one lost pencil. And then I turn back to the inmates and say, hey, guys, please, if you have the pencil, like no problems from my side. It happens. Just drop it on the table and we can all leave. In fact, why don't we do this? Why don't we all turn our backs? We'll stand in a circle around the tables. We'll turn our backs. Everyone will just kind of stand here and we'll all like clap our hands and tap our feet so that the person who has the pencil can turn around and drop it off without anyone knowing. It seemed like a really great idea to me. Well, no pencil. Okay, at this point, the officers have lost their patience and they come storming down the hall to find the missing pencil. And as they burst through the door, one of the inmates points at my head. And then I realize the missing pencil has been holding my hair in a bun through the entire class. I was so mortified. I can't even tell you how embarrassed I was. And luckily, everyone, both the inmates and the officers, had a really good sense of humor about it. But from then on out, pretty much every class, one of the inmates always checked my hair for any missing pencils. But to be totally frank, it was initially a really unsettling and terrifying experience to go behind bars. And I had the unique privilege that many don't who are there that I could leave of my own accord. And as the first class progressed for me, it became clear that I was safe, that I was okay in a room without an officer and just a radio by myself. And in fact, the inmates told me if anything happened, they had my back. And that was awesome because I felt at that point that I had really earned their respect. And our class, the storytelling class, became the largest attended programs class in the entire program department. And that was so amazing to me. And I loved it. In fact, we had to break into more than one class because there were so many people who wanted to take it. And we ended up developing not just straight storytelling classes, but we ended up developing literacy classes that focused on criminogenic factors, that looked into narrative stories and worked with people to help them overcome a variety of different traumas in their life. And honestly, it is one of the most rewarding things that I have ever done. Now, again, as safe as I feel, I know that in order to be safe, all of those rules from the very beginning in that orientation must be followed. There is not an exception. I guess, you know, I was always a kid who felt that rules were made to be broken. And luckily, I'm an adult who knows when to follow them and when not to.
Well, there you go, folks. Stories can come from the most unlikely of places. That list from the orientation, it would never occur to me that my skirt would have to be a particular length. I've never had anyone ask that as I go to give a program somewhere. So I'm super happy that, you know, we've known each other for several years, and I knew that you had this program going, but I never realized, you know, the intensity of it or the availability of potential harm, I guess we could call it. And so, my goodness.
I would say every facility that I have worked at in a variety of different counties have done an amazing job of keeping everyone safe in those situations. And that is a stressful, full-time job that people
definitely
do. And they definitely don't
seven.
Get it. Yes. And you seven. Have to be hyper vigilant all the time. There is not a moment to like chill out and surf through Facebook on your phone, because if you do that, it can cause a potential disaster. And I'll be honest, one time I was in a lockdown and they locked the jail down. And that was very, it was very difficult because remember, you're in there with no phone, so you can't communicate to anyone. And I was supposed to be picking my kids up from school, but now I can't because I'm locked down in a jail for an indeterminate amount of time because, and no one tells you anything, because they can't tell you anything because it could compromise security, you know, and things like that. So that was the only time that I felt a bit like I couldn't breathe. But every other time I was there, honestly, everyone treated me with the utmost respect and always do. I've never been in a situation that made me feel uncomfortable.
Well, folks, it's Thursday night and you've tuned in to So What's Your Story. Brooke Pilafont is our guest. Now, we don't do this by ourselves. We should mention our sponsor, the Houston Storytellers Guild. And that's a great place to learn about the art of stories and storytelling. They meet virtually on the fourth Tuesday of every month from 7 to 8:30. You can check their website to find out and get that link for that Zoom session. You can also go on that website and find past programs of So What's Your Story under their link for radio program. Our friends at the Moth down at Warehouse Live, they're back in full swing the second Tuesday of each month. And you enjoy hearing astonishing stories there and get to know Houston storytelling community. And Brooke would remind us all that storytelling is all over the state of Texas and beyond. And Brooke, both of us love telling stories, but not everyone feels their voice has value. Through your work with inmates, the participants, you hear valuable stories of life, overcoming obstacles, and frankly, survival. Can you tell us your stories from the Iron Hotel?
I can. And just like all of our stories, some are full of laughter and love, and others are wrought with obstacles and trauma. And so in each of our classes that we've done, I have felt very honored that many of the participants trusted me enough to share some of their most vulnerable memories. And as they took a risk in opening up, their pain began to heal, and you could see a visible shift in their entire demeanor. In several instances, the correctional counselors shared with me that through telling one of their stories in my class, they were able to begin the healing process and finally talk about instances that affected their lives. And each class that we do has a theme. It could be writing about your first job or telling about your favorite childhood toy. But in this class, I challenged students to write on the theme of darkness in whatever capacity it resonated with them. And here's one of their stories. Darkness is when you are homeless and alone in this world, even though your family lives less than 20 miles from where you call home, which in reality is a tent with no electricity or utilities that normal people have, begging for food or money to survive because your family disowns you as a son or a brother. Then depression kicks in and the drugs become a part of life to numb the pain of darkness, pumping the poison called meth into my veins more and more every day until all I think about is where and how am I going to get my next fix and my next needle, doing more and more each time, not caring about my health and well-being anymore. And before you know it, you look in the mirror one day and don't even recognize yourself because you're 60 pounds underweight, nothing but skin and bone, literally. And then telling yourself it's almost over, just a few more days and life will be over and the pain will end with it. At that point, somehow you end up in jail, looking at some time in prison, and you realize that this isn't where you want to be, but you're here for a reason. There is a plan for you, and it's not time to go home to God. So this is where my story ends for now. Hopefully not forever, as I hope there is a part two. I hope there is a point where I find the light of life rather than the darkness of the world. But at this point, only time will tell. Darkness has been a part of my life for a very long time. But I stay optimistic that one day I will have so much light in my life, I will forget the darkness. In some of our classes, inmates are given a beginning line, and they have to write a true narrative as a response. And that can be very interesting as far as results go. The stories are so varied because people have such interesting experiences. And in this class, the inmates were asked to finish the following statement. I never expected. And here's one of their stories. I never expected that my life would turn out the way it has. As a child, I wanted to be an adult, but now as a man, I yearn to be the person that I was as a child. If I could go back to the beginning, to start again, I wouldn't lose myself. I'd do things right. I guess as it stands, I am an outlaw. And outlaws, by definition, don't follow the rules. And as such, not all my ideas and opinions will fit with the sensibilities of liberal society. Then again, how can I be an outlaw if I'm in jail? Does that make me an in-law? Because I know how people often dislike their in-laws. Well, whatever I am, I never expected to be this way. The road less traveled, but for a reason. They say money is the root of all evil. They should be saying not having money is the root of all evil. Because if I had it, I wouldn't be here. I tried winning the lottery, but of course, the odds were against me. Then I prayed to God for some cash until I realized he doesn't work that way. So I went out and stole some and asked for his forgiveness instead. I guess God was doing something else when I prayed for forgiveness. Too bad he's not a more active listener. Maybe if there was a phone app somewhere and I could leave a message, things wouldn't have gotten fumbled. You see, I was kidnapped. The perpetrators are holding me for a ransom of $200,000. I've been appointed a negotiator by my captors, but she won't answer my phone calls and seems not to be very committed towards securing my release. However, for 10% of my ransom, I can get an expert in the KNR, kidnap and ransom field, known as a bail bondsman. They have a high rate of success in rescuing hostages. But my family can't come up with the money. So here I remain. And what did I do wrong? I allegedly removed some stacks of paper from some buildings. So those papers might have had pictures of dead presidents on them. And the buildings happened to be banks. But I never expected to be caught in a frame-up. With all their video footage and condemning statements by the girl I thought I loved, but obviously didn't love me. I didn't want a life like this, and I want to change. If the destination is the journey, maybe it's time to take a break. The only beauty held by the past is that it can't be changed, but in it is held such pain. If I could go back and begin again, this time I would stay true to the person I was. This time, I would know what to expect. So as Rough Draft began to expand, we also began to include poetry classes. And here is a reflective poem written by an inmate. It's titled, Me, Myself. I ask myself this question. Why is my poetry so dark? I answer my reflection. Because it comes from your heart. This cannot be, I say to myself. Perhaps I should provide a spark. Fire and gasoline? I reply, you'll blow us both apart. Is there nothing else? I ask me. Do I have no joy? You once did, comes my response. It died when you were a boy. How did this happen? I demand myself. Is there no other way? Search yourself, me replies I. In darkness, we must stay. I surely think not, I say to me. Be gone from my sight. For without you to drag me down, I will go search out the light. Many of their stories and poems are of pain, suffering, abandonment, and isolation. And these pieces are powerful for healing, but not always the easiest for others to hear. They give a voice to a truth often buried deep within someone's life. And when expressed, the trauma they hold within the mind and the body can begin its release.
Does it surprise you to hear phrasing and wording and concepts like that from the inmates, from the participants?
Yes, but in the most beautiful way, it surprises me.
Yep.
It like touches a space in my heart that releases so much joy. And I don't even know how to describe it. Almost like light explodes out of your chest because you're just so taken back. And especially from people who will be like, I hated school. I never went to class. I dropped out. And yet they have these very profound thoughts and ways that they put words together and convey their own sense of self.
The idea with the theme of darkness, when you bring up a theme like that, do you anticipate where the stories are going to go, or is it really just all over the map? Some are very literal about darkness, things happening at night, and others are, you know, the darkness of the soul, that sort of thing. Are they just all over the spectrum?
Yes, they are. And that's the reason that I pick those kind of key words, is because I want words that will give things all over the map. I want the students in the class to hear that a single word can conjure such amazing stories in people and such varied experiences that we have. And to just, you know, and to me, that's part of what makes the class really amazing, is that everyone comes from a different perspective. And so we also talk about the fact that, like, when you say something, someone else might be hearing something totally different, you know,
yes.
even in a single word.
Yeah. And the poetry, does the poetry add an additional, I guess what I would say is, not everybody can be a poet. Not everybody has the dream in life to be a poet. Are people drawn particular sets of poetry, or different types of topics bring up poetry, or is that a separate class all in itself?
So the poetry is generally a separate class in and of itself that blossomed out of a storytelling class I did where we wrote an ode to a boring object. There was, you know, and I told them from the very beginning, this is not about crafting something that is going to be, you know, hailed as the greatest piece of literature since, you know, Shakespeare. This is about just being creative, because a lot of times people who experience trauma get locked in their trauma and they can't get out into the creative sections of their brain anymore. And so from doing those odes and just being silly and having fun, we developed poetry classes. And one of the best responses that we've had in that is honestly working with the veteran pods. We've done it in several different counties, and I'll be honest, I'm amazed. I'm always amazed at the number of people who want to be a part of that class, enjoy it, and really put a lot of thought and effort into the poems that they write.
I'm just sitting here speechless, which is never a good thing for somebody hosting a radio show. I mean, first of all, I just want to tell all the folks out there that these are the kinds of experiences that storytellers rarely get to have. Generally speaking, you're in an auditorium, you're on a stage, people are expecting this and that sort of story. And from your perspective, you're throwing a topic out and receiving stories back. And those stories bring with them sometimes pain, sometimes sorrow, but sometimes also some humor and some goodness. And it's I have to give you some applause for this Rough Draft. Now, folks can find Rough Draft online. If they're not driving right now, they can They can get on their computer at home when they get there, or they can get on their phone or their laptop and look at roughdrafttx.com. And as you,
.org.
That means you're not selling anything. That's good.
We're not, we're a nonprofit.
Nonprofit, so it's .org, roughdrafttx.org. And Brooke, just real quick, I know you're super busy. Thank you for coming out with us tonight and sharing some of these tales. Give us one parting thought about rough draft.
I would say that every person's path you cross has a story to tell, and every voice has value.
Well, there you go, folks. Every voice has value, and that's what we like to see here on So What's Your Story on KPFT 90.1 Houston's community station. Brooke, let me just put you on the spot here. You'll come back and tell us more stories on So What's Your Stories in the future, won't you?
Oh, I would love to.
Outstanding. Outstanding. Well, it's time for us to kind of groove out of here, but I guess, folks, if you're listening out there, just make sure that you find a story, and people have stories inside them, and get those stories out. Don't forget, you're listening to member-supported programming here on KPFT. We want you to make 90.1 a part of every day, whether you're home or you're driving home or you're just chilling at the park. Be sure to join us every Thursday at 5 p.m. for So What's Your Story. We want you to keep on loving great stories and keep listening for those voices that don't that aren't often heard. And we'll keep bringing them to you here. My name is Larry Thompson. I'm happy to be your host. And once again, Brooke, thanks so much for being here with us.
And thanks for having me.
Heck yeah, we'll do it again. And remember what author Colin McCann said. Things in life have no real beginning, although the stories we tell about them always do. Good night, y'all.
Donating a car you don't need to KPFT is an easy way to help us bring you your favorite music and news in crazy times like these. We'll arrange to have it picked up, get top dollar for it, and invest the funds back into the station. Learn more at kpft.org or call to donate your car to 855-KPFT-CAR.
In honor of Women's Month, join us for a special presentation of Women in Congress, a documentary public affairs presentation produced by Dr. Robert Franklin, KPFT General Manager. The documentary takes a historical look at the role of women in the political process, from the election of Jeanette Rankin, a representative from Montana in 1916, to Shirley Chisholm's election in New York in 1968. The documentary explores the plight of female members in the United States Congress and the Republican and Democratic Party. Hear part one tomorrow afternoon at 4 here on KPFT.
Hi, thanks for listening to KPFT. KPFT has always provided us with music and public affairs we don't hear anywhere else. It's not mainstream, and that's how we like it. Please support community radio and join KPFT. Call 713-526-5738 now and pledge your support. My name is Jane, and I'm a listener member of KPFT Houston.
Hello, Houston. This is your blue-eyed soul child, Bob Barovich, producer and host of the award-winning radio program Gospel Memories. For the past 20 years, Gospel Memories has brought listeners a steady stream of gospel, spiritual, and jubilee classics, as well as interviews with some of the great artists who recorded them. Now Gospel Memories can be heard in Houston on Sundays at 10 to 11 p.m. over KPFT 90.1 FM. The show features an hour of music from a collection of more than 25,000 recordings, covering some 8 decades of gospel music. Singers, duets, trios, quartets, groups, choirs, some nationally famous, others more regionally known, including artists from right here in Houston. So join us every Sunday at 10 p.m. for great gospel, spiritual, and jubilee music, the soundtrack of that old-time religion on KPFT 90.1 FM, Houston's community station.
You're listening